Thank you for joining us for the September 13th Tuesday reading of the Boulder Daily Camera, the Longmont Times Call, and the Colorado Daily. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles from the Daily Camera: Calling 911, Boulder to Begin Emergency Nurse Navigation, by Deborah Swearingen. 100 years after compact, Colorado River nearing a serious crisis point, by Chris Outcault and Brittany Peterson. War with Russia. Ukraine reclaims more territory, reports capturing many POWs, by Elena Bekatoros and Hannah Arhirova. Sentenced to probation, man takes plea deal for harboring missing teen, by Mitchell Byers. And following up with miscellaneous articles, the following main articles from the Longmont Times Call: Rocky Mountain National Park, Longmont native donates 40 acres, by Matthew Bennett. Criminal justice, man pleads not guilty in child porn case, by Mitchell Byers. Wildfires, multiple counties face highest risk of home losses, by Aldo Svaldi. FBI raid, Trump pick okayed by feds for Mar-a-Lago special master, by Eric Tucker. And following up with miscellaneous articles, we'll be finishing up today's reading with miscellaneous articles from the Colorado Daily. From the Daily Camera: Calling 911, Boulder to Begin Emergency Nurse Navigation, by Deborah Swearingen. As of about midday today, people who call 911 in Boulder will have access to a new emergency nurse navigation program. The program, a partnership between the city and American Medical Response, is largely meant to ensure people are receiving the appropriate type of care instead of being sent to the emergency room in an ambulance, regardless of their situation. Boulder is the first community in Boulder County to implement such a program into its 911 systems. Similar programs are in place in 10 other states, as well as Washington, D.C. Here's how it works. A person calling 911 will initially speak with a dispatcher who may opt to transfer them to a Colorado State licensed nurse for assessment. The nurse navigator could recommend a variety of next steps, including a virtual visit with a board-certified emergency physician, home health suggestions to best meet a patient's need, or a non-ambulance transport to a non-emergent local healthcare provider. The nurse will make recommendations based on a person's insurance coverage. This does not affect people who call 911 with true emergencies. For example, anyone who calls in to report having trouble breathing or chest pain or an injury from a fall, a seizure, heart attack, or severe allergic reaction will continue to be sent an ambulance and a Boulder Fire Rescue engine. However, if the dispatcher determines a call is less critical, the person will have the option to instead speak with a nurse navigator. The emergencies are still going to be handled as emergencies. This kind of handles what we term lower acuity type calls, Boulder Fire Rescue's EMS Administrator Jenna Stieg said. Ultimately, the patient benefits from more direct communication and care that can save them time and money and will reduce Boulder's call volume, potentially by 8 to 10%, Stieg said. The new service is exciting for AMR too. AMR has proudly served the community of Boulder for 10 years, Brittany Buss, operations manager of AMR Boulder, stated in a city news release about the program. Our partnership with the city is important to us, as is being able to enhance our services and care to area residents through the launch of the Nurse Navigation Program. Together, we will ensure that every patient reaches the right level of care while simultaneously making our EMS system more efficient and effective. In making the decision to begin the program, Boulder considered data from other cities that have started similar programs. It's helpful to have framework and information from others to go on as the program evolves. It's not reinventing the wheel, but it's really tailoring it to our community, Stieg said. According to Stieg, One piece of data indicates that 20% of those who use the program reported being satisfied with medical advice from a registered nurse and ultimately did not require a medical visit at all. It was a no-brainer for us that it would be a really good thing to implement here in our community, she said. Some people with mobility issues call 911 because they're unable to get to a doctor without transportation assistance. The new Emergency Nurse Navigator program can help with that, since a nurse will now have the ability to call an Uber or Lyft for a person to get to and from the doctor's office. Additionally, the Nurse Navigator team with AMR will call the patients back to ask how the person is doing and whether their experience using the program could have been better. Normally, that's something that's kind of difficult to capture, Stieg said. If there are problems, we'll know about the problems, too. Boulder is hopeful the program will reduce its emergency response call volume while saving people time and money along the way. However, no one will be forced to use the program. If people feel more comfortable with an ambulance ride to the hospital, that remains an option, Stieg confirmed. Additionally, people are reminded that the service is not an advice hotline. People calling 911 should do so if they are experiencing an emergency. A trained dispatcher will determine whether a person might be better suited with the nurse navigator. And if a nurse navigator determines there is, in fact, an emergency, they can always dispatch a team of first responders. The Emergency Nurse Navigation Program service begins on Tuesday. A nurse navigator will be available all day, every day. There is no additional cost to the city or community members, as the service is part of the agreed-upon terms of AMR being the contracted ambulance provider for the city. 100 years after Compact, Colorado River nearing a serious crisis point, by Chris Outcault and Brittany Peterson, The Associated Press, Denver. The intensifying crisis facing the Colorado River amounts to what is fundamentally a math problem. The 40 million people who depend on the river to fill up a glass of water at the dinner table, or wash their clothes, or grow food across millions of acres, use significantly more each year than actually flows through the banks of the Colorado. In fact, first sliced up 100 years ago in a document known as the Colorado River Compact, the calculation of who gets what amount of water may never have been balanced. The farmers of the compact and water leaders since then have always either known or had access to the information that the allocations they were making were more than what the river could supply, said Ann Castle, senior fellow at the Getches Wilkinson Center at the University of Colorado Law School. During the past two decades, however, the situation on the Colorado River has become significantly more unbalanced, more dire. Drought scientists now believe the driest 22-year stretch in the past 1,200 years has gripped the southwestern U.S., zapping flows in the river. What's more, people continue to move to this part of the country. Arizona, Utah, and Nevada all rank among the top 10 fastest-growing states, according to U.S. Census data. While Wyoming and New Mexico aren't growing as quickly, residents watch as two key reservoirs, popular recreation destinations, are drawn down to prop up Lake Powell. Meanwhile, Southern California's Imperial Irrigation District uses more water than Arizona and Nevada combined, but stresses their essential role providing cattle feed and winter produce to the nation. Until recently, water managers and politicians whose constituents rely on the river have avoided the most difficult questions about how to rebalance a system in which demand far outpaces supply. Instead, water managers have drained the country's two largest reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, faster than Mother Nature refills them. In 2000, both reservoirs were about 95% full. Today, Mead and Powell are each about 27% full. Once healthy, savings accounts now dangerously low. The reservoirs are now so low that this summer, Bureau of Reclamation Commissioner Camille Tautan testified before the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee that between 2 million and 4 million acre feet would need to be cut next year to prevent the system from reaching critically low water levels, threatening reservoir infrastructure and hydropower production. The commissioner set an August deadline for the basin states to come up with options for potential water cuts. The upper basin states, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Wyoming, submitted a plan. The lower basin states, California, Arizona, and Nevada, did not submit a combined plan. The Bureau threatened unilateral action in lieu of a basin-wide plan. When the 60-day deadline arrived, however, it did not announce any new water cuts. Instead, the Bureau announced that predetermined water cuts for Arizona, Nevada, and Mexico had kicked in and gave the states more time to come up with a basin-wide agreement. Still left out, a week before Tahltan's deadline, the representatives of 14 Native American tribes with water rights on the river sent the Bureau of Reclamation a letter expressing concerns about being left out of the negotiating process. What is being discussed behind closed doors among the United States and the basin states will likely have a direct impact on basin tribes' water rights and other resources, and we expect and demand that you protect our interests, tribal representatives wrote. Being left out of Colorado River talks is not a new problem for the tribes in the Colorado River Basin. The initial compact was negotiated and signed on November 24, 1922, by seven landowning white men who brokered the deal to benefit people who looked like them, said Jennifer Pitt of the National Audubon Society, who was working to restore rivers throughout the basin. They divided the water among themselves and their constituents without recognizing water needs for Mexico, the water needs for Native American tribes who are living in their midst, and without recognizing the needs of the environment, Pitt said. Mexico, through which the tail of the Colorado meanders before trickling into the Pacific Ocean, secured its supply through a treaty in 1944. The treaty granted 1.5 million acre feet on top of the original 15 million acre feet that had already been divided, 7.5 million each for the upper and lower basins. Tribes, however, still don't have full access to the Colorado River. Although the compact briefly noted that tribal rights predate all others, it lacks specificity, forcing individual tribes to negotiate settlements or file lawsuits to quantify those rights, many of which are still unresolved. It's important to recognize the relationship between Native and non-Native people at that time, said Daryl Vigil, water administrator for the Jicarilla Apache Nation in New Mexico. In 1922, my tribe was subsistence living, Vigil said. The only way we could survive was through government rations on a piece of land that wasn't our traditional homeland. That's where we were at when the foundational law of the river was created. Competing interests. Agriculture uses the majority of the water on the river, around 70% or 80%, depending on what organization is making the estimate. When it comes to the difficult question of how to reduce water use, farmers and ranchers are often looked to first. Some pilot programs have focused on paying farmers to use less water, but unanswered questions remain about how to transfer the savings to Lake Powell for storage, or how to create a program in a way that would not negatively impact a farmer's water rights. Antiquated state laws mean the amount of water that a water right gives someone access to can be decreased if not fully used. That's why the Camblin family ranch in Craig in northwest Colorado plans to flood irrigate once a decade, despite recently upgrading to an expensive, water-conserving pivot irrigation system. 9 years out of 10, they'll receive payment from a conservation group in exchange for leaving the surplus water in the river. But in Colorado, the state revokes water rights after 10 years if they aren't used. Not only would losing that right mean they can't access a backup water supply should their pivot system fail, but their property's value would plummet, Mike Camblin explained. He runs a yearling cattle operation with his wife and daughter and says an acre of land without water sells for $1,000, about a fifth of what it would sell for with a water right attached. There are other ways to improve efficiency, but money is still often a barrier. Wastewater recycling is growing across the region, albeit slowly, as it requires massive infrastructure overhauls. San Diego built a robust desalination plant to turn seawater to drinking water, and yet some agricultural users are trying to get out of their contracts since the water is so expensive. Some cities are integrating natural wastewater filtration into their landscaping before the water flows back to the river. It's all feasible, but is costly, and those costs often get passed directly to water users. War with Russia. Ukraine reclaims more territory, reports capturing many POWs, by Elena Bekatoros and Hanna Arhirova. The Associated Press, Kharkiv, Ukraine. Ukrainian troops expanded their territorial gains Monday, pushing all the way to the country's northeastern border in places, and claimed to have captured a record number of Russian soldiers as part of the lightning advance that forced Moscow to make a hasty retreat. A spokesman for Ukrainian military intelligence said Russian troops were surrendering en masse as they understand the hopelessness of their situation. A Ukrainian presidential advisor said there were so many POWs that the country was running out of space to accommodate them. Blue and yellow Ukrainian flags fluttered over newly liberated towns across a wide swath of reclaimed land. The Ukrainian military said it had freed more than 20 settlements in 24 hours. In recent days, Kyiv's forces had captured territory at least twice the size of Greater London, according to the British Defense Ministry. After months of little discernible movement on the battlefield, the momentum has lifted Ukrainian morale and provoked rare public criticism of Russian President Vladimir Putin's war. In some areas of the front, our defenders reached the state border with the Russian Federation, said Oleh Sinibhubov, governor of the northeastern Kharkiv region. The counteroffensive left the Kremlin struggling for a response to its largest military defeat in Ukraine since Russian forces pulled back from areas near Kyiv after a botched attempt to capture the capital early in the invasion. The Russian Defense Ministry acknowledged the setback in a map that showed its troops pressed back along a narrow patch of land on the border with Russia, a tacit admission of big Ukrainian gains. Reports of chaos abounded as Russian troops pulled out. The Russians were here in the morning. Then at noon, they suddenly started shouting wildly and began to run away, charging off in tanks and armored vehicles. Dmitry Hushenko, a resident of recently liberated Zelesnechi, a small town near the eastern front lines, told Sky News. Video taken by the Ukrainian military showed soldiers raising the Ukrainian flag over battle-damaged buildings. In one scene, a fighter wiped his boots on a Russian flag on the ground. Other videos showed Ukrainians inspecting the wreckage of Russian military vehicles, including tanks. In his evening address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his forces have liberated more than 2,300 square miles in the east and the south since the beginning of September. Now Ukrainian teams are disarming landmines and other unexploded weapons in the recaptured areas and searching for any remaining Russian troops, officials said. It was not yet clear if the Ukrainian blitz could signal a turning point in the war. Momentum has switched back and forth before, but rarely with such a big and sudden swing. Ukrainian presidential advisor Oleksiy Arestovych could not specify the number of Russian prisoners, but said the POWs would be exchanged for Ukrainian service members held by Moscow. Military intelligence spokesman Andrei Yusov said the captured troops included significant numbers of Russian officers. Ukraine's deputy interior minister accused fleeing Russian forces of burning official documents and concealing bodies in an attempt to cover up rights violations in the areas they controlled until last week. The mood was jubilant across the country. In Kharkiv, authorities hailed that power and water had been restored to about 80% of the region's population, following Russian attacks on infrastructure that knocked out electricity in many places across Ukraine. "You are heroes," Kharkiv Mayor Ihor Terekhov wrote on Telegram, referring to crews who restored utilities in Ukraine's second biggest city. "Thanks to everyone who did everything possible on this most difficult night for Kharkiv to normalize the life of the city as soon as possible." Meanwhile, in Russia, signs of disarray emerged as Russian military bloggers and other commentators chastised the Kremlin for failing to mobilize more forces and take stronger action against Ukraine. Russia has continuously stopped short of calling its invasion a war, instead describing it as a special military operation and relying on a limited contingent of volunteers instead of a mass mobilization that could spur civil discontent and protest. Ramzan Kadyrov, the Moscow-backed leader of the Russian region of Chechnya, publicly criticized the Russian Defense Ministry for what he called mistakes that had made the Ukrainian blitz possible. Even more notable, such criticism seeped into state-controlled Russian TV. People who convinced President Putin that the operation will be fast and effective, these people really set up all of us, Boris Nedesin, a former parliament member, said on a talk show on NTV television. "Now we're at the point where we have to understand that it's absolutely impossible to defeat Ukraine using these resources and colonial war methods." Sentence to probation. Man takes plea deal for harboring missing teen by Mitchell Byers. A Boulder man arrested after detectives found a missing 14-year-old girl at his home in May has accepted a plea deal in his case. James Wendell Dean, 51, pleaded guilty on September 6 in Boulder District Court to a felony count of violation of a custody order and a misdemeanor count of harboring a minor. As part of the plea agreement, attorneys agreed that Dean would serve 2 years of probation with the condition that he not have any contact with the named victim. The probation will be unsupervised if he remains out of state, but will be supervised if he resides in Colorado. He was also sentenced to 118 days in jail, but was given credit for time served as he had been in custody while awaiting the resolution of the case. Dean was originally also charged with sexual exploitation of a child, but prosecutors dismissed that charge in July due to the state of the evidence. Boulder County District Attorney's Office spokeswoman Shannon Carbon said Dean would be looking at prison time were he to violate the protection order again. "We worked closely with the victim's family leading up to the plea, and given the amount of jail he served while the case was pending, the sentence in this case is the right result," Carbon said in a statement. In addition, the input from the victim's family was important in determining the right outcome, particularly with regards to the no-contact order and the consequences for any violation. The 14-year-old girl was reported missing on May 11th after going to Manhattan Middle School, 290 Manhattan Drive, according to a release. She walked into the school, but was marked absent from all classes. According to an affidavit, Dean was already under investigation for having an ongoing illegal sexual relationship with the girl. The day after the girl was reported missing, police searched Dean's unit in the 5100 block of Santa Clara Place in Boulder, as well as the unit of his adult son who lived upstairs, but officers did not find the girl. According to a release, detectives with the Boulder County Digital Forensics Lab worked with members of the FBI and the Boulder County Drug Task Force to track a social media post made by the girl after she went missing to Dean's residence. Detectives applied for a warrant to search Dean's residence again 2 days after the girl was reported missing, and this time were able to find her hiding in the bedroom. The girl admitted that she had also been hiding in the bedroom the first time police searched Dean's residence. Friends of the team also told detectives the girl had been planning to run away with Dean for months and that they helped her by moving her clothes to his place or letting her use their phones to communicate with him and send him photos. According to the affidavit, Dean initially claimed the teen showed up at his home just before searchers arrived. But after being confronted with the girl's statements, Dean said, "She showed up, emotional, freaking out, crying, scared to death. What was I supposed to do?" Court records show a judge had granted a temporary restraining order against Dean, in which the teen was a protected party at the time she was found in his home. Court date set. Former Boulder City employee accused of embezzlement by Mitchell Byers. A Boulder City employee has been arrested and resigned after officials said he used his work credit card to make personal purchases. Trent Felica, 57, was arrested on suspicion of one count of embezzlement of public property, a Class 5 felony. Felica turned himself into a Boulder County Sheriff's Office on Sunday and was released on a $500 cash bond. He is set for a first appearance in court on September 26th. According to a release, Felica is accused of using a city credit card to purchase personal equipment. He was investigated by the Boulder Police Department and a warrant was issued on Friday, according to online court records. The affidavit has not yet been released. City officials said Felica was a traffic signal maintenance supervisor and had worked for the city in a variety of roles for nearly 20 years, but has since resigned. "Clearly, this employee is entitled to all the rights afforded by our legal system. However, these allegations are extremely troubling," said City Manager Nuria Rivera Vandermeid in a statement. "One of our core values is integrity. All city employees, and especially those who have access to resources, have a responsibility to be good stewards both of taxpayer dollars and our community's trust. As soon as we became aware of this possible violation, we referred the case to police for a thorough investigation." In Daily Camera obituaries published today, Pat Patterson, January 4, 1944 to August 26, 2022. Pat left this world on August 26, having been diagnosed with cancer this summer. There will be a full obituary and details of a celebration of his life in the Post-Independent paper in Glenwood Springs, which you can find online. Dean I. McMurray, January 29, 1935 to September 10, 2022. Dean I. McMurray was born in Greeley, Colorado, January 29, 1935 to Irvin J. McMurray and Helen K. Walling McMurray. He passed away September 10, 2022 in Norton, Kansas at the age of 87. Dean attended schools in Greeley, graduating from Greeley High School. He married Ruby Scott and, to that union, four children, Steve, Kevin, Lynn, and Pat, were born. He served in the U.S. Army for 2 years during the Korean conflict and was stationed at Fort Ord in Monterey, California. After his military service, the family returned to Greeley. Dean accepted employment with Hested Stores Company, becoming a store manager. This job took the family to Denver, Ogallala, Nebraska, McCook, Nebraska, Oakley, Kansas, and Norton. In 1968, they became the owners of Rainbow Lanes for 9 years. Dean then became the advertising manager for the Norton Telegram. When the couple separated, he moved back to Colorado. In time, he married Suzanne Bruning Parson of Boulder, and they continued to live in Boulder. One of the joys of his life was having a cabin at Grand Lake, Colorado, and having family come to visit. He was an avid trap shooter, winning many shoots, and returned to Kansas often for pheasant hunting and to visit family. Dean was preceded in death by his wife, Sue, parents, and maternal grandparents. He is survived by his four children, brother Jerry, Janet McMurray, six grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and other family and friends. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, September 13, 2022, at the funeral home. Visitation will be from 12 noon before the service. Burial will be at Green Mountain Cemetery in Boulder, Colorado. Memorial contributions may be made to the charity of your choice and sent in care of Plumer Gobber Funeral Home, 215 West Main Street, Norton, Kansas, 67654. Condolences may be left at PlumerGobber.com. Michael P. Brand, June 8, 1985 to September 4, 2022. Michael Patrick Brand passed away on September 4th at his home in Boulder, Colorado. Born in Watertown, New York, he was a graduate of Canna Johari High School, class of 2003. He received a Bachelor in Business Administration from the former Western New England College and a BS in Physics from Colorado University at Boulder, CU. He moved to Boulder, Colorado in 2015. He was currently a PhD student and research assistant in the Electrical Engineering program at CU. Michael received honorable mention for the National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship in 2020. Michael loved learning. He was fiercely inquisitive, a voracious reader, and had a multitude of interests. He loved the beauty present in the natural world and loved his home in Colorado for its mountains and majestic views. He found joy and solace in music of all genres and attended numerous concerts over the years. Most importantly, Michael had kindness and love in abundance in his heart for his family, friends, and colleagues. Michael will be deeply missed by his devoted parents, Barry and Terry Johnson Brand, beloved brothers, Timothy and his wife, Sarah, of Sarasota, Florida, and Paul and his wife, Shannon, of Wrentham, Massachusetts, treasured grandparents, Evelyn Brand, Janet Hunter, and Paul Johnson, cherished nieces and nephew, Claudia, Aaron, and Hazel, his girlfriend, Molly Ketchuk of Ludlow, and their shared sweet dog, Seibel, as well as many loving aunts, uncles, and cousins. Michael also had a broad CU and Boulder network of dear friends and colleagues. A celebration of life service will be held on Sunday, September 18th, 2022, at 12 noon at Wilbraham Funeral Home, 2551 Boston Road, Wilbraham. Family and friends may gather to visit and share memories prior to the service from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Wilbraham Funeral Home. Memorial contributions in Michael's name may be made to the Colorado University Collegiate Recovery Center Fund at https://giving.cu.edu/fund/or/DakinHumane Society at www.dakinhumane.org. Turning to the Longmont Times Call, Rocky Mountain National Park, Longmont native donates 40 acres by Matthew Bennett. Rocky Mountain National Park got 40 acres bigger Monday thanks to a land donation from former astronaut and Longmont native Vance Brand. It's a pristine county. I'd hate to ever see this sort of thing disappear completely from America, Brand said during a ribbon-cutting ceremony Monday, not far from the Rocky undeveloped property. As far as our family is concerned, this is for the American people. Roughly 9,000 feet above sea level and 4 miles northeast of Long's Peak summit, the 40-acre tract will provide a natural buffer between private lands and popular trails such as Estes Cone, Storm Pass, and Eugenia Mine Trails. Brand purchased the land in 1967. When we first came in here, the dirt road didn't come up this far, so we trekked in here. We didn't even have a path, Brand said. Through the years, we always thought we'd build a house up here, but I didn't get that much leave time. In addition to serving as commander aboard the Columbia and Challenger space shuttles during missions in 1982, 1984, and 1990, Brand was one of three U.S. astronauts and two Soviet cosmonauts who participated in the Apollo-Soyuz test project in 1975, which was the first international human space flight. Surrounded by family members and Rocky Mountain National Park employees, Brand cut the red ribbon at Monday's ceremony and even enjoyed a pastry to celebrate. After all, in accordance with the law, the land donation required an act of Congress to complete. Congressman Joe Neguse introduced bipartisan legislation in 2019 for the land donation, which Congress later approved. Former U.S. Senator Cory Gardner and current Senator Michael Bennett championed the bill in the Senate. Rocky Mountain National Park Superintendent Darla Seidlitz said the land donations to parks don't happen very often, and that she was especially grateful to the Brand family for their generosity. "It's beautiful," Seidler said of the 40 acres being donated. Brand's desire is to keep the 40 acres undeveloped, so we will definitely honor his wishes. Susan Brand, who is Vance Brand's oldest daughter and works at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston as a science integration manager, made the trek up to Rocky Mountain National Park on Monday to celebrate the donation alongside her dad. "It's really exciting to be able to donate property that you firmly believe will be retained in its natural environment for the future of our population, the public," Susan Brand said. "We love it, and we absolutely love sharing with others what we love." Criminal Justice: Man Pleads Not Guilty in Child Porn Case by Mitchell Byers. A Longmont man accused of downloading child pornography has pleaded not guilty in his case, but attorneys are still waiting to set a trial date. Matthew King, 38, pleaded not guilty to sexual exploitation of a child on September 6, according to online court records. King was set for a motions hearing on November 2nd, but Boulder County District Attorney's Office spokeswoman Shannon Carbone said attorneys were still trying to work through some evidentiary issues before setting a trial date. The trial would have to take place within 6 months of King's not guilty plea, unless he elected to extend the deadline on his speedy trial rights. He remains out of custody on a $5,000 cash bond. According to an affidavit, an associate of King's told a Boulder police officer in January 2021 that King had shown them child porn. The Boulder police officer notified the Longmont Police Department about the allegation because King lives in Longmont. Police then used a program called CyberCheck, which the affidavit described as an open-source intelligence and reconnaissance platform. Using some of King's information, the program was able to scan the web and found some instances of King downloading child pornography based on IP address, email addresses, geolocation, and usernames being used to perform the downloads. Police served a search warrant at King's house on July 14, 2021, and seized electronic devices. On the same day, police learned King was being held at a mental health facility after expressing suicidal ideations. Police interviewed him there, and King confirmed with the officer that he has a sexual attraction to young children and was frustrated that society portrays him as a monster due to his sexual desires and that he uses a computer as a tool to keep from acting upon those desires with an actual child, according to the affidavit. Wildfires: Multiple Counties Face Highest Risk of Home Losses by Aldo Svaldi. Nearly 320,000 single-family homes in Colorado are at risk of wildfire damage, with potential losses highest in El Paso County, according to CoreLogic, a property information firm that prepares an annual wildfire report. California, Florida, Texas, Colorado, and New Mexico are the top five states in terms of the number of homes susceptible to wildfire damage, CoreLogic estimates. But given their much smaller populations than the first three states, Colorado and New Mexico are more vulnerable on a percentage of homes basis. Colorado's Front Range is a geographic feature that encompasses some of the largest concentrations of wildfire risk in Colorado, said Tom Larson, Senior Director of Insurance Solutions at CoreLogic, in an email. The large number of homes nestled along the wildland interface defines the risk here. El Paso County has 38,560 single-family homes at risk of wildfire damage, the largest number of any county in the state. Eagle County is next, with 24,048 homes at risk, followed by Jefferson County with 23,164 homes, La Plata with 21,637 homes, and Douglas County with 20,827. Close to 3 out of 4 homes in La Plata and Eagle counties are at risk of destruction in a wildfire, whereas closer to 3 out of 20 homes in Douglas and El Paso counties are at risk. About 1 out of 10 homes in Jefferson County could end up in the path of a fire, based on statistics on housing units from the State Demography Office. Boulder County didn't make the top five list in Colorado, even though residents there lost more than 1,000 homes worth around $500 million at the end of last year during the fast-moving Marshall Fire, which reached deeper into the suburbs than imagined possible. El Paso County lost nearly 350 homes in the Waldo Canyon Fire in June 2012. CoreLogic said that wildfires have burned 6.8 million acres a year on average in the country during the past decade, and in 3 years, the losses topped 10 million acres. From 1983 to 1992, wildfires consumed an average of 2.7 million acres per year. A separate report from Redfin found that 90% of homes built so far this decade in Colorado face wildfire risk, compared with only 23% of those built from 1959 to 1990. The 66% gap is the largest of any state, even California, which went from a 39% share of new homes at fire risk historically to 91%. FBI raid, Trump pick okayed by feds for Mar-a-Lago special master, by Eric Tucker, the Associated Press, Washington. The Justice Department said Monday that it was willing to accept one of Donald Trump's picks for an independent arbiter to review documents seized during an FBI search of the former president's Florida home last month. The accommodation could help accelerate the selection process and shorten any delays caused by the appointment of the so-called special master. The judge in the case, granting a request from the Trump team, said last week that she would appoint a neutral arbiter to go through the records and weed out any that may be covered by executive privilege or attorney-client privilege. Department lawyers said in a filing Monday night that, in addition to the two retired judges whom they earlier recommended, they would also be satisfied with one of the Trump team's selections, Raymond Deary, the former chief judge of the federal court in the Eastern District of New York. He is currently on senior active status, and the department said he has indicated he was available and could perform the work expeditiously if appointed. It was not immediately clear whether U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon would name Deary or someone else. The Trump team said earlier Monday that it opposed both Justice Department selections. The back and forth over the special master came as Trump's lawyers, in a 21-page filing Monday, dismissed the former president's retention of top secret documents at Mar-a-Lago as a storage dispute and urged Cannon to keep in place a directive that temporarily halted key aspects of the Justice Department's criminal probe. The Trump team referred to the documents that were seized as purported classified records, saying the Justice Department had not proven that the materials taken by the FBI during its August 8th search were classified or remain so now. The filing underscores the significant factual and legal disagreements between lawyers for Trump and the U.S. government as the Justice Department looks to move forward with its criminal investigation into the retention of national defense information at Mar-a-Lago. Department lawyers in their own filings have rejected the idea that the documents, many of them classified at the top secret level, belonged to Trump, or that Mar-a-Lago was a permissible place to store them. This investigation of the 45th President of the United States is both unprecedented and misguided, they wrote, in that at its core is a document storage dispute that has spiraled out of control. The government wrongfully seeks to criminalize the possession by the 45th President of his own presidential and personal records. The investigation hit a roadblock last week when Cannon granted the Trump's team request for a special master and prohibited the department, for now, from examining the documents for investigative purposes. The Justice Department has asked the judge to lift that hold and said it would contest her ruling to a federal appeals court. The department said its investigation risked being harmed beyond repair if that order remained in place, noting that confusion about its scope had already led the intelligence community to pause a separate risk assessment. But Trump's lawyers said in their own motion Monday that Cannon should not permit the FBI to resume its review of classified records. It said the government had unilaterally determined the records to be classified, but had not yet proven that they remain so. In opposing any neutral view of the seized materials, the government seeks to block a reasonable first step towards restoring order from chaos and increasing public confidence in the integrity of the process, the lawyers wrote. Both sides on Friday night proposed different names of candidates who could serve as special master, though they disagreed on the scope of duties the person should have. Cannon has said the yet-to-be-named arbiter would be tasked with reviewing the documents and segregating out any that could be covered by claims of either executive privilege or attorney-client privilege. The Justice Department recommended either Barbara Jones, a retired judge in Manhattan who has served as special master in prior high-profile investigations, or Thomas Griffith, a retired federal appeals court jurist in the District of Columbia who was appointed to the bench by former President George W. Bush. The department said in its proposal that the special master should not have access to classified documents or be empowered to consider claims of executive privilege. On Monday, the Trump team told the judge it was objecting to both those candidates, but was not prepared to say why publicly at the moment. Trump's lawyers proposed either Deary, a senior judge on active status in the federal court in Brooklyn, who also previously served on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or Florida lawyer Paul Huck Jr. They have said the arbiter should have access to the entire tranche of documents and should be able to evaluate executive privilege claims. The Justice Department said it was willing to support Deary's selection, but opposed the selection of Huck because of what it said was a lack of relevant experience. In its filing Monday, the Trump team again voiced a broad view of presidential power, asserting that a president has an unfettered right of access to his presidential records and absolute authority to declassify any information without the approval of bureaucratic components of the executive branch, though it did not say, as Trump has maintained, that he had actually declassified them. In the obituary published today in the Times Call, James Edwin Lewis, October 19, 1935 to August 31, 2022. James Edwin Lewis, 86, has left his earthly home on August 31, 2022 in Woodburn, Oregon. A beloved husband, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and friend to many. We love you, Daddy. James will be honored with a Jimmy family and friends reunion. Please join us on Saturday, October 15th, 2022 at 21875 County Road No. 7, Berthoud, Colorado, 80513. Time, 2 p.m. Food and beverage provided. Daniel H. Brewington. Daniel H. Brewington was born in Maine on July 14, 1967, and passed away in Meade, Colorado on September 8, 2022. Daniel Brewington was a beloved member of his family and community and will be dearly missed. For more information on services, where to send donations, or to read a full-length obituary, please visit thenaturalfuneral.com/obituaries. Transportation. Pressure mounts on unions and U.S. railroads to reach a deal. By Josh Funk, The Associated Press, Omaha, Nebraska. Freight railroads and their unions are facing increasing pressure from business groups and the White House to settle their contract dispute before Friday's looming strike deadline. The pressure stems from concerns that halting railroad deliveries of raw materials and finished products that so many companies rely on would be, in the words of the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, an economic disaster. A White House official said President Joe Biden and members of his cabinet were in touch with the unions and railroads Monday as part of their efforts to avert a strike. And for the second time in the past week, Labor Secretary Marty Walsh sat down at the negotiating table Sunday to urge the parties to reach a deal. Walsh postponed a planned trip to Ireland this week to remain close to the talks. A Labor Department spokesperson said Monday that it's crucial that the parties remain at the negotiating table and come to an agreement because a shutdown of our freight rail system is an unacceptable outcome for our economy and the American people. Suzanne Clark, the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, said Monday that a national rail strike would be an economic disaster, freeing the flow of goods emptying shelves, shuttering workplaces, and raising prices for families and businesses alike. The Chamber joined a number of other business groups, including a coalition of 31 agricultural shipping trade groups, in sending letters to Congress urging lawmakers to be prepared to step in and block a strike if the two sides can't reach an agreement by the end of the week. The Chamber said if it comes to that, Congress should impose the terms recommended by a presidential emergency board that Biden appointed this summer. The Association of American Railroads Trade Group put out a report last week estimating that shutting down the railroads would cost the economy $2 billion a day. The coalition negotiating on behalf of the nation's biggest freight railroads, including Union Pacific, CSX, Norfolk Southern, BNSF, and Kansas City Southern, has announced 8 of the 13 tentative agreements needed to avert a strike by some 115,000 rail workers. The deals that have been announced so far have closely followed the Presidential Emergency Board's recommendation that called for 24% raises over 5 years, $5,000 in bonuses, and one additional paid leave day a year. But the two biggest unions representing conductors and engineers have been holding out because they want the railroads to go beyond those recommendations and address some of their concerns about strict attendance policies and working conditions. The railroads have said they would begin curtailing shipments of hazardous materials and some other goods Monday in advance of a possible work stoppage at the end of the week. That would ensure that containers of those dangerous goods aren't left stranded along the tracks. The heads of the sheet metal, air, rail, and transportation workers, Transportation Division Union that represents conductors, and the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen Union that represents engineers, criticized that decision as a move to increase pressure on shippers and Congress to intervene. The federal law governing railroad contract talks won't allow a strike or lockout before Friday. From the Colorado Daily, CU Boulder, Sexual Misconduct Task Force Takes Shape, by Annie Mell. Following a report of sexual assault at Williams Village North last month, the University of Colorado Boulder has announced a new sexual misconduct task force. It is starting to address and prevent the crime. The campus on August 26 released an announcement about its new task force, which will be led by the Office of Institutional Equity and Compliance and the Office of Victim Assistance to expand CU Boulder's sexual misconduct prevention efforts. The task force, which was planned over the summer, will work across the campus to review sexual misconduct survey data and will then recommend prevention tactics to be implemented on campus, wrote Len Pomeroy, Associate Vice Chancellor of OIEC and Title IX Coordinator at CU Boulder, in an email. We use the 2015 data to understand the relationship between sexual assault, retention, and belonging, an evidence-based risk factor in sexual assault, to investigate practices that had an impact on reducing sex assault rates among our undergraduate students, Pomeroy wrote. We need to continue to enhance those efforts based on the 2021 results. Pomeroy said a key finding in the 2015 survey showed that only 8% of CU Boulder undergraduates who reported that they experienced sexual assault reported it to the OIEC or law enforcement. Additionally, only 10% indicated that they utilized confidential support services on campus. In response to that survey, OIEC started CU Boulder's Don't Ignore It website to increase an understanding of reporting options and resources available to students. We need to continue to rely on data to inform our approach, and that is the same strategy the task force will use in response to the 2021 results, she wrote in an email. The 2020-2021 annual report from OIEC also shows that it responded to a total of 1,371 cases, all of which were reported to OIEC directly or by a third party, the report said. Of those cases, 541 were allegations within the scope of the sexual misconduct, intimate partner, violence, and stalking policy. 720 were related to concerns under the discrimination and harassment policy, and 5 were related to the conflict of interest in cases of amorous relationships policy. Thank you for joining us for the September 13th Tuesday Boulder Daily Camera, the Longmont Times Call, and the Colorado Daily. My name is Diane Adler.